Welcome to the inaugural episode of Talk Without Pants, where all the talk is nerdy and pants are optional. Today's episode is brought to you by the letter N for nerdy.
Well, there's just no escaping that, is there?
No.
Go ahead, put it right out there. I'm not even a geek. I'm a nerd.
Well, geeks and nerds are both welcome here at Talk Without Pants. I'm your host, Tom Hesser, and today we have two guests that I know for a fact are super geeky, or else they wouldn't be here. First up is Mr. Jeff Gamet, who I know as being a big Star Trek geek. Thanks for being on the show, Jeff.
Oh, sure thing. And thanks for having me here. And how appropriate that the podcast is pants optional.
Yes. Well, I knew you had to be involved in some way if there were going to be no pants involved. And our second guest is Ken Ray, part of the Rebel Alliance and a traitor. Thanks for being on the show.
Take me away. Want to hear me play? Yeah, thanks a lot, Tom. I appreciate it. It's kind of fun to not necessarily talk Mac stuff.
Well, that's the thing is, I mean, that was kind of the inspiration because I listened to a lot of your guys' podcasts, and you know, you're always slipping in Star Wars or Star Trek references or something like that, and I feel like, oh, these guys are just aching to talk more science fiction and geek stuff besides Mac stuff, which you probably do like 22 hours a day.
Yeah. Can I really quickly, just briefly on the whole Mac thing, say a quick congratulations to Jeff Gamet for being interviewed by Reuters to talk about Steve Jobs leaving.
Ooh. Oh, thanks. Oh,
way to go. Yeah. And I wish you and Trip Chowdhury had been in the same room because I'd have given you $5 to punch him.
Actually, you wouldn't have needed to pay me quite that much.
If people haven't seen it, they should go find it because, wow. I mean, first of all, it's great to see Jeff. But then second, I mean, I was, you know, to bring it back to the whole geek thing, I was practically Incredible Hulk angry. I was Dr. David Banner or Bruce Banner, I guess, in the TV show sitting there. My eyes went white. Luckily, I already wasn't wearing pants, so they didn't burst at the seams. But had I been, they would have been.
Yeah. Okay, so picture me there with a high-def camera on me the whole time and not knowing when I was actually on screen or not.
Right.
So see if you – anyone that's listening, see if you can figure out the points in the podcast or in that little interview where – it took all of my self-control to keep from hulking or rolling my eyes so far back in my head in disgust that I could see my own medulla oblongata.
Best Police album ever, by the way.
That was a really good album.
I had that as a blacklight poster in high school.
That's very nice. Yeah, wow. That's I feel like I was actually right on that cusp that didn't get that, the whole like blacklight poster and things like that. That was for like kids a little bit older than I was. Like I had cousins who had like the Houses of the Holy poster and stuff like that. You know, I wasn't that guy, unfortunately.
Oh, I came in at like the end, I think, of the blacklight thing. They would still occasionally do it like at the skating rink and stuff like that, but. I had gotten it as a gift. I got like a little plastic blacklight and a selection of posters. I don't know if they were just random or if I actually went out and got the Police blacklight poster specifically because I like the Police, but it didn't last very long. it just made the room look that much dirtier.
Let me really quickly tell you, you say like they used to do in the skating rinks. It's just that you quit going.
Oh.
I went to a friend's 40th birthday party earlier this year, and her husband thought it would be fun if we all go skating like we used to. And it was really like we used to. I mean, nothing has changed since we were teenagers, which is like really creepy because, you know, sort of like you said about it not looking very clean. It kind of there too.
Mm-hmm. You know, on the not looking clean thing, I've wanted to do black lights in my bedroom, and, you know, as a kid, teenager, whatever. And my dad, who has been involved in a lot of different scientific things over the years, he takes me aside and he goes, "Now, you know, Jeff, this is probably not a good idea, so you should rethink this." And I went, "Okay, Dad, why?" And he said, "Well, you're aware that urine and semen fluoresce under black light, right?" And I went, "Thanks, Dad."
Nice.
And you know, that was some of the best advice he could have ever given me, so I did not do the black light.
God.
And I'll use this point to remind everyone this podcast does have an explicit tag just for this reason.
Oh, and there you go. I'm the guy that brought it up first.
That's
go.
Usually the way it is. That's usually the way it is. Be honest.
Yeah. Yeah, you know me so well.
Okay, so can I forgive me? I don't want to railroad. I don't want to start anything.
Go on, throw it out there.
I don't
throw it
be
out
that
there.
Guy. Why are we interested in science fiction? And this sounds like a crazy thing, except I spend a lot of time wondering if my fascination / obsession with science fiction, not with particular titles, but with sci-fi, is well-founded, or if it speaks to an arrested adolescence.
So Ken, you're taking us to the philosophical side.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. Isn't that why we do it? Is that why we do it? I mean, or do you just watch it for like the who can blow what up? Because I was thinking earlier, and yes, I'm very much taking this to the philosophical side, because it's where I spend, honestly, I mean, not to bring it back to Apple, but the reason I've said it before on Day Six, which is my paid show. The reason that I follow Apple as closely as I do, the reason I love following Apple, not just because people, you know, like hearing me talk about it, which I'm very grateful for which I'm very grateful. And, you know, the fact that I've got the premium show and all that stuff. It's because they're the closest thing to Star Trek that I feel like I have access to at this point. I mean, not working at MIT, not, you know, working at IBM or at Xerox PARC. Just being a general consumer, it feels like it's the closest thing that I have to the future that I want to see. And what I'm trying to figure out is, I mean, I think to 90% of the population, that's just dumb. Not why you follow Apple, but taking science fiction seriously. I feel like to 90% of the world at large, maybe more if you go outside the States, but I would say in America, somewhere between 80 and 90% would think it's stupid to take science fiction seriously. And I doubt you two feel that way, but I guess what I'm wondering is why are we the type of geeks that we are? Not with the Apple stuff, but with the whole sci-fi thing.
You know, I would speculate that it's because we are forward thinkers and we are comfortable working outside the box, so to speak.
Okay.
And the excitement of what the future holds is a big thing for us.
All right.
Okay, so here we go. As a little kid, seeing things about the moon landings and where we were at that time with the space program, you know, we also had the Skylab thing happening. All right, so we had real spacemen. And I remember the first Star Trek episode that I saw. And here's where I lose a geek cred point, because I can't remember the name of it. It's the one where they had
the first aired one or the
one? No, the first one that I actually saw.
Oh, okay.
And it's the one where they go to the planet where there's the library and there's just the librarian there and they can go back in time.
Oh, with Marriott Hartley.
Yes, that's the one.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of that one either now.
But okay, but the point is, I see Kirk, Spock, and McCoy jump through the portal, and I'm like, oh my god! And then there's the special effect where Kirk is feeling along on the brick wall to find the portal back, and his hand disappears through the wall, and it stopped my heart because I had never seen something like that on television before, and so that coupled with what we had really happening in the world really sparked an interest in what potential we have. And it's fun to have your own image that you've created of what the future may hold for us, but it's also really enjoyable to see what comes out of other people's minds too, which leads us right into shows like Star Trek.
Hmm.
And I don't want to be Star Trek heavy necessarily, but it is kind of almost the quintessential example. And the example Jeff gives is kind of poignant because the library, all the information in the library are on these little metallic discs that are a little bit smaller than a CD.
They almost look like hard drive bladders, actually.
Yeah, and like you'd set them in this little holder, and then that would show you like a pictorial or text bit of information, whatever you were looking at. And in the episode, they were using it to conjure up historical points in their past for them to escape to. But it's that's the thing with Star Trek, and maybe this is only a viewpoint you can have with hindsight, but when you look at it, I mean, and people talk about this all the time, a lot of the things in Star Trek that seem fantastical and ridiculous, we now actually have. Is technology we're actually using, whether it's cell phones as communicators or the iPad as a pad, all that kind of stuff. And that's kind of what I find exciting is, and the interesting thing is kind of that speculating forward of going like, well, what's technology or what's society going to be like in the future? What are the options? Where does it go if we make these decisions? And, that's what attracts me is this kind of speculative thing where, well, we already know the history of our world and we can watch what's going on TV, but what's going to happen in the future and what kind of crazy things are we going to come up with?
Okay, so that gets to the other exciting question, what's going to happen in the future?
Which I know stuff.
Yeah, I know. I mean, there's one problem that I have with Star Trek. There's only one. Well, there are several problems if you go episode by episode. But there's one problem that I have with Star Trek. It seems to be the only like utopian future, and it's not even completely utopian, but it seems to be the only utopian future that we have going for us at this point. I've been spending before Wednesday when Jobs quit, retired, stepped up, whatever you want to say. My show was actually going to be about the capital F future. And it's one that I've done two or three times because it feels like it's something that's, I mean, the future is constantly in motion, right? I mean, it's always changing. And so I talk about it from time to time, mostly because I want people to think about what we want the future to be rather than just, you know, say, oh, yeah, well, that'll be neat one day, maybe. Or more commonly, that'll never happen because. Now, I'm trying to remember, is there a good version of the future besides Star Trek? Because I think of Blade Runner, I think of Minority Report. I mean, it had its problems. I mean, there's some really neat stuff as far as technology, but I have a feeling that the Minority Report future is awesome for the rich.
Yeah, probably.
As opposed to being awesome for everybody. And I'm trying to think of, is there another one that works out well for most, if not all of the people? Besides Star Trek?
Well, it's interesting. I don't know if it counts exactly.
It's your show. Of course it does.
Well, the thing is, I've been rewatching Space 1999. And although you really don't see anything that's happening on Earth, or really the society in a large scale, you do get an impression that... maybe not to the point that Star Trek has, but that, you know, people, you know, they get along and they're, you know, about getting educated. They're still throwing away nuclear waste on the moon, which is a bad thing. But but everyone seems to be getting along really well. And they've got, you know, elements of a utopian society going on. They just don't know how to discard things properly.
Now, that's interesting because that is not what I got from Space 1999.
Really?
Yeah, my assumption was that Earth was dealing with serious environmental issues to the point that they had to invest in a disposal system on the moon because they were generating so much nuclear waste and that there was all kinds of political backstabbing and infighting going on. And that you had this moon base where they were to a degree insulated from all of the issues on Earth, but they still had to deal with that to a degree. And I mean, like in It has been so long. So if I have my episodes wrong, I apologize up front and feel free to call me out anyhow. I believe it's in the pilot episode. There is a politician that has come to the moon base and is, and I can't remember what he's doing, but it causes stress for a lot of people. Then when the moon is thrown out of orbit, and if you haven't seen the series, sorry for the spoiler.
Dude, I was going to watch it next week.
You're welcome. I just saved you all that time.
Oh, good. Thanks.
Anyhow, so they have this politician that is not happy to be there and is doing everything he can to get the hell away from there and back to Earth. And so, assuming there are people out there that have not seen the series and are planning on watching it, I won't delve deeper into that part, but there were things like that, and then there were some flashback scenes that they had done, I think it was in the second series, where they showed some life on Earth before the moon was gone, and they were dealing with political issues.
I haven't gotten that far yet, so maybe... Maybe that's just my impression of Moonbase, but everything seems like very white and orderly, and
that doesn't necessarily though make everything good, right? I mean,
true.
Like I'm thinking about, I don't know. I mean, there are some great like individual works, I think, like the robot novels by Isaac Asimov, or some of the just standalone novels by Arthur C. Clarke. Things like Fountains of Paradise or, Fountains of Paradise. I guess I'm going to go with that. Rendezvous with Rama initially, but then when he expanded that into a series, then suddenly it turns out humanity is just as ugly as it was. But, is that because of Arthur C. Clarke or is that because of his co-author for the expansion, Gentry Lee? Asimov, talked about society to an extent, like men still don't talk in the bathroom in the caves of steel. and on Earth, everybody lives in like these domed cities, and not because there's something wrong with the atmosphere, but because they've become very, I don't want to say xenophobic, because they're not necessarily afraid of other people, although they are.
Like germophobic or...
Well, not exactly agoraphobic. They're afraid of the outdoors. If you fly from one place to another, first of all, you don't. If you fly from one place to another, it's because there is an incredible emergency. You're a very powerful person or you're being called someplace by very powerful people. And there's not enough time to take ground transportation. Because ground transportation from New York to D.C. only takes about 3 hours, I think, 3 to 4 hours. And it's all in a series of walkways that just go faster and faster and faster, which is a really neat idea. But if you've got to be there quicker, you fly. And the deal is, no human would willingly go through the air on Earth in Asimov's Caves of Steel or The Naked Sun. And actually, every airplane is like a tube that you cannot see out of, because otherwise people would just lose their freaking minds. They can't think about the fact that they are not covered by something, that they're not inside something. And then as the novels progress, you go to other planets where people have very different thoughts and very different ideas. But you still don't get the sense, that it's... utopia by any stretch of the imagination. Things seem to be okay for everybody, but it's not healthy necessarily. It's just like every individual is all right in it.
All right. Well, if we're going to go with the apparent utopian idea,
okay,
might as well throw Logan's Run in there too.
I was thinking that.
You see, I actually had that in my notes. The only problem is, it's great for everybody under 29.
That's true. And then once you hit 30, and it's time for Carousel, all of a sudden it's not so much a utopia anymore, is it, kids?
Renew.
That's right.
I'm wondering if maybe The Matrix wasn't the worst idea. I'm not kidding. Seriously, I'm not sure that everybody in The Matrix didn't make some horrible decision for the rest of humanity, because most people were, bebopping along happy as a clam, not realizing that they were powering something else, kind of like, people on Earth today, or kind of like, the allegory of the people in the cave by the Greek guy, as they might be giants, puts it. What's the allegory? You know the one I'm talking about? The shadows on the wall scare the people in the cave, and so they stay in the cave. And then one character whose name escapes me, and I feel really bad because this is like this is just something that should be in all of our heads. Decides that he's going to go outside, and it turns out what's outside are not giants casting shadows, but people casting shadows to keep the other people in the cave frightened.
How did I not know this?
Yeah,
right now,
it's actually one of the. And it's mentioned in the They Might Be Giant song, and I can't think of the name of it. You guys talk about something else. I'm going to turn down my mic so I can clack away on my keyboard for a second.
Okay.
Sounds good. And I'm going to feel back really lame when you come back and I go, oh, right, I remember that now. So that gives us all something to look forward to.
I was thinking of Logan's Run as well, except for that whole over 30 thing. But I guess it's interesting because I just saw a Star Trek episode where they met a society where they went more into depth about that. But after you reach the age of 60, you would commit kind of a ritual suicide. And that was their solution so that people didn't have to worry about taking care of their elderly parents or becoming a burden on society or anything.
Yeah, that's actually a Next Generation episode, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I think it's in season three, I think.
That's right. I remember. And there was the guy that was going to kill himself or was supposed to kill himself was a renowned scientist in their community. And the potential he had to as a scientist to improve their society was critical and irreplaceable, and yet he was expected to do this anyhow. And now I'm trying to remember. I can totally see the actor that played the guy, and
it's the guy from MASH that played Charles Winchester.
Oh, right. And because we're actually recording right now,
David Ogden Steers.
Thank you. I couldn't remember his name.
No problem. Go ahead, please continue.
No, we were just filling time for you. How'd that search go?
It's From the Republic by Plato.
Plato
imagines a dialogue with himself and Socrates. Socrates begins by describing a scenario. Wikipedia, by the way, so you know it's true.
there you go.
It does jog enough memories that this is right. Socrates begins by describing a scenario in which what people take to be the real world is, in fact, an illusion. He asks Glaucon to imagine a cave inhabited by prisoners who have been chained and held immobile since childhood. Not only are their arms and legs held in place, but their heads are also fixed, compelled to gaze at a wall in front of them. Behind the prisoners is an enormous fire, and between the fire and prisoners is a raised walkway along which people walk carrying things on their heads, including figures of men and animals made of wood, stone, and other materials. The prisoners watch the shadows cast by the men, not knowing their shadows. There are also echoes of the wall from the noise produced from the walkway. So the long and the short of it is basically once the guy gets outside, suppose further that the man was compelled to look at the fire, wouldn't he be struck blind and try to... The long and the short of it, as I remember, I'm going to stop reading now because it's boring to hear somebody read a Wikipedia page. One of the guys in the cave realizes the truth, that what they're seeing on the wall is not reality. What they're seeing on the wall are just shadows cast by other people, basically looking to keep them afraid. And he comes back and tells the people that it's just that, that it's just, you know, stuff to keep them afraid. And they kill him. Because, you know, he's wrong. I mean, it is reality, and he's challenging their reality, and they can't have that, so they're done with him.
And that sounds about right.
And so that's the whole Matrix thing. So Neo goes out and he finds out about the Matrix, and he goes back in to try to free everybody. Do people really want to be free? I mean, it's fairly close to utopia as long as you don't know, you know, how it's made. But then even if you did know how it was made, I mean, it's like Cypher. Would you want to be out, or would you want to be rich and inside, or healthy and inside, or laid and inside?
Let's go for laid, yeah.
The world created in the Matrix presumably was a lot like real world before they wrecked everything on the planet. So it wasn't very utopian. I mean, compared to having to rough it in a cave, on a planet where everything's scorched and everything, I suppose it's better there that you can like have an apartment and all these simulated niceties. But really, it was the Matrix was just the world as we know it. It wasn't really a utopia.
Well, keep in mind, utopia is very subjective. So for the machines that were running the Matrix, they had utopia. They had their beautiful machine world, and they had all their copper tops providing all the juice they needed.
Well, bear in mind, too, what Agent Smith said. There have been several versions of the Matrix. They originally tried to make one that was utopia, and people couldn't hack it. They wanted their fights. They wanted their struggle. They didn't want to live in peace. And that actually, I mean, that does not sound far off to me oftentimes. And that sounds really dismal and depressing. And I certainly hope we get past it at some point, but it really seems to me that we'd rather fight than the other F.
True. But yeah.
Sorry.
Filibuster.
Filibuster. Exactly.
Isn't that yes. TH? No, I don't know.
Yeah,
what was I going to say? The way I understood it is, and it's I think it's saying the same thing, just kind of from a different perspective. But the idea being that when they tried to create a perfect world, it wasn't so much that they chose a world that was imperfect. They just couldn't believe in the perfect world because it's like, what? No fighting? I can't believe this is real. And then they would kind of wake up. And they couldn't believe that they were in a real world unless it was dirty and gritty and had all these problems. So, which is kind of a sad state as a snapshot of society at any particular point, because it's probably true. If we woke up and suddenly there were no problems, our mentality would be, oh, there's something wrong.
Well, it goes back to the whole thing from the Republic, right? I mean, we once it is revealed to us that there's actually no reason to fight, that there's no reason to fear, that there are no monsters, we kill the guy who says that because there have to be. It's what I know. Mm. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, so I'm not saying it's utopian, except, well, I don't know. It seems to me it's, whatever.
Well said.
Whatever. Thank you very much. That's all I got. This is where I honestly, you know, worry sometimes if I think about it a little bit too much. At the same time, do you know what Steve Wozniak is doing next month? I mean, aside from walking around with $20,000 in his pocket and not being aware of how much money he's actually made.
Is he flying in Spaceship One to the moon or something?
No, I'm sorry. October 19th and 20th. He's actually speaking October 20th at the IP Expo 2011. His talk, along with one of the other guys from IO Fusion, because he works with them now, his talk is titled Today's Science Fiction, Tomorrow's Science Fact. It's not stupid to think about this stuff, but I mean, for some reason, it feels like it's stupid if you're not, you know, a millionaire. It's kind of funny to me. Like kids will come up with ideas for, like, you know, an alternate universe, and their parents will say, "Quit being stupid," and then, you know, you go to MIT,
and then those kids become accountants.
Well, no, but then there are people who are like, you know, positing how it is that we could have, you know, multiple universes and sort of like, well, how do we? So basically, I need a doctorate in something theoretical to come to the same idea that, you know, some kid had a while ago. Why couldn't there be more than one universe?
Well, the difference being once you have your doctorate, yes, your mom can't tell you quit being stupid.
I guess that could be it.
Unless you're still living in her basement or something.
See, the weird thing, I'm rambling. I know I'm rambling. This is kind of like...
It's good rambling, though.
All right, fine.
When you think about it, I mean, sure, it's all written up nice and tidy when you read about Plato and philosophy and stuff, but you got to figure when they were actually doing this, it was just a bunch of guys talking, rambling, going off on tangents, and finally someone collated it into some ideas that were a little bit easier to understand. So we're just doing the same thing they were.
All right. I'll be a Plato for the new millennium then.
There we go. Put that on your letterhead.
Yep. And then run me through the Plato fun factory and see what comes out.
That's totally awesome.
Yeah, there you go.
Ken Ray, modern day Plato.
Modern day Plato. Yep.
The kind you can eat or the non-toxic rubbery kind?
I would not say that I'm non-toxic.
Oh, okay.
So buyer beware.
But you can take him through the fun factory.
Yeah, totally.
And he's very shape.
All right.
Anyway.
Malleable.
Malleable, that's the word.
So I didn't mean to go all sideways. I guess that was my point. You want to talk about Batman?
No, that's actually I like that we kind of went straight for the higher brow stuff.
Sweet.
Because
yeah,
you know,
so now we have that out of the way and we can go right to gutter humor.
Exactly. That'll be fun.
That's phase two. The thing is I don't want this to just be like a geek news program because there's plenty of those out there already. So I like that people are bringing these kinds of concepts up here because it's interesting to throw these ideas around, even if they're kind of conceptual or so forth. But it is with the podcast, the difference is, you know, instead of like we all getting another beer and talking into 3 o'clock, at some point we've got to, you know, quit. And that's the only downside is because somehow we have to get a point across in a limited amount of time.
Oh, no.
Real? Wow. Apparently I've missed a critical point of podcasting all these years.
Really?
Oh, no. I'm with you on the time thing. It's just the making of, I mean, if we're supposed to arrive at a point, then cut out the last 20 minutes. Cause dude, I got no point at all there. I mean, I think my point in all of that would boil down to sort of what Douglas Adams said in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, 2000 years after somebody got nailed to a tree for saying, wouldn't it be good if we were nice to each other all the time? That honestly is what it comes down to. I think the reason I love Star Trek so much is somewhere in there, we found a way to do that. Yeah, except for the people with bumps on their foreheads. Those guys are total
douches.
Asshats. They're
asshats.
I'll go ahead and break the profanity seal there. I mean, those guys are total asshats, and they apparently need a smackdown until their world almost blows up, and then we'll be friends with, you know, some of them, the Klingons, Star Trek VI, whatever it was. But we still won't be nice with the Kardashians. Kardashians, not the Kardashians.
Well,
that's right. They have headphones,
the
too.
Yeah, well, practically. Practically. So, I mean, I don't know. There's a dude, seriously, I am going to sound like the biggest lunatic by the time this is over.
Now, the people that will listen to this podcast will know exactly where you're coming from.
Say again?
The people who will listen to this podcast will know exactly where you're coming from.
Okay. Well, then let's go ahead.
So I'm okay with you sounding kind of weird or as a lunatic, because maybe it'll make people think I'm a little more normal.
No, that's true. That's possible. Because they agree with me, or because as long as they don't sound as crazy as me, they're cool.
That's all I'm going for right there.
Take your pick.
All right.
But I may have to redefine what I mean by point. I don't mean necessarily by conclusion, but you know, and express an idea or ask a question that gets some answers or something like that.
Okay.
But often philosophical talk could really go on endlessly if you'd let it, because you just keep adding points and tangents and things like that.
That's true. I have another one.
Oh, okay. Well, wait. Let's ask Jeff if he has anything he wants to throw in there, a new subject or something.
No, I'm actually excited to see where Ken drags us next.
Okay, well, back to Ken.
Drags us, wow.
Well, okay. By drag, I mean...
He didn't say kicking and screaming.
No, not kicking and screaming. No.
All right.
I'm really going to have a hard time digging myself out of that one. So I'm just going to say, tell me more, Ken.
Okay. Here was the other thing that I was wondering about before we started today. Science fiction right now. And let's leave Legacy out. Let's leave Doctor Who. Let's leave Star Trek.
Okay, future. Anything not created yet?
Well, no. No, but let's leave old stuff out. I mean, Star Trek has been around for over 40 years. Doctor Who has been around for over 40 years. They have, I mean, their direction was set a long time ago. And certainly they've rebooted Doctor Who over the past few years, and they've rebooted Star Trek just in 2009 with the J.J. Abrams version. But what I'm wondering about is new science fiction, particularly on TV, it seems. What's happened over the past decade? In the 90s, it was a lot of aliens. And it was a lot of government conspiracy, you know, brought about, I think, largely by the X-Files. Mm-hmm. But then maybe it was just people glomming onto the X-Files. But lately it's been, with the exception of something like The Event on NBC, which was aliens landing and the government sort of hiding it. So that kind of feeds into the X-Files thing. No Ordinary Family, Heroes, Alphas, Being Human to an extent. There seems to be less of this. There seems to be less of the... we're all being kept down, and more of the, yeah, even Twilight, if you want to go that far. We're individuals getting powers now. Do you think that there's an overall thing that's being said by what's going on in society today that is what people are glomming to?
I'm going to say yes. I think that people really like the idea of the normal guy, which mm-hmm. includes them, of suddenly being able to rise above their position. And I'm not just talking about like in a caste system, but to become more than they are. And in most cases, to simply have it happen and not have to work to get this new status. And I think there's a lot of people that really like that notion. And there you go.
I think there's also a really strength, a real strength today in that even though comic books have been around for a really long time, you know, you've seen that there's more and more comic books coming to film and also on television. So you have to wonder if it isn't like a certain age group, the ones that are okaying or creating these shows, are thinking back to when they were kids and reading comic books and going like, ooh, I want superpowers.
That's an interesting idea. I know Stan Lee has talked in the past about one of the things that's so appealing about the X-Men for teenagers is teenagers are going through, or at least back when he created it, teenagers are changing. Their bodies are changing. Their minds are changing. What they think about the world is changing. And they feel like mutants. And so he created this school for mutants, basically, that sort of gave largely teenage boys something to glom onto. I mean, all these changes are actually things that could end up being good things. I mean, not necessarily acting as a foster parent to get people through adolescence, but kind of like, you know, something that they might resonate with or might resonate with them. Now, so do you think it's just, okay, well, I grew up with, you know, the idea of Superman. I grew up with the idea of the X-Men. So now when I go to sit down at, you know, 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central. What I want to see is something that's going to give me that same sort of feeling of being able to get past whatever it is, or is there something different there?
I think there's a couple things. The first one is getting exactly what you just said. I think another part of it is nostalgia, because there's a whole generation of us that grew up with the X-Men and with this high school kid that suddenly has spider powers. And you know, so we have that whole world that we remember, and having that concept presented to us in a compelling way is kind of cool, because there's the nostalgia thing. I think the other thing that plays into this, we can totally toss out all the philosophical stuff, all of the highbrow stuff. It's about money. Because once you get one popular show like that, everyone immediately gloms on and starts doing their own version. And that's playing into a lot of what's going on with the whole superhero genre on television and in movies right now. It's as much as I would love to think this is about people looking at the philosophical value and the allegories that come out of the whole man versus Superman sort of thing. It's money.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, yes. But why? You're not wrong. I'm wondering, though, why there is money to be made in that right now. I mean, not everything works, right?
No, not everything works. But
the cape was highly anticipated, and it failed. And there have been other science fiction, like sort of, well, The Bionic Woman I thought the Bionic Woman was great, and it fed my nostalgia thing and all of it. And it lasted, I think, 4 episodes.
Wait, the newer one or the original one?
The new one.
The new one.
Yeah, that was too bad.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It was 4, maybe 6 episodes.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really interesting and modernized version of the original Bionic Man story.
Right. And, well, especially with like the failed Bionic Woman still running around screwing up the planet.
Right. Yeah.
That was awesome. So like, oh, you're 2.0 actually. And we don't want to talk about 1.0.
Right. Yeah. So that was actually really well done, but for whatever reason, it didn't catch on. And
I have to admit, though, when I watched it, I didn't get the same feeling I had when I watched the original $6 Million Man and Bionic Woman. There was something, maybe it was because at the time there weren't a lot of shows where people had any kind of superpowers, per se. But it almost seemed too normal.
Well, I think the Bionic Man story told as it was back in the '70s, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, early '70s.
Okay, so that story told as it was then, if it was done now the same way, would never make it past the pilot. And that's because the way people look at the world and what they expect out of their entertainment is not the same as it was back then, which is why the new Battlestar Galactica, while very much, okay, in many ways like the original, it could not be the original because that white hat, black hat sort of storyline, that just wouldn't work anymore. Because that's not what people are looking for in their characters.
They want complex characters as opposed to good versus evil. They want good versus evil who's sometimes good and sometimes evil but keeps screwing over the good but doesn't know why he's doing it.
Well, they want complexity.
Yes.
Sure.
I mean, go back even to what were Steve Austin and Jamie Summers? Steve Austin was an astronaut, which would have been a big deal in the 70s and would not, I mean, no offense to anyone who's into the space program, but would not be a big deal to the average viewer today. Being an astronaut today is not what being an astronaut was in the early 1970s. And then Jamie Summers was a tennis pro. Really? I mean, in the time of Billie Jean King and Martina Navratilova, and you had 3 channels, and so you were going to end up watching women's tennis, whether you liked it or not. So it meant something to be a tennis pro, or it meant something to be an astronaut. And now, I mean, you could just as easily have somebody who's a spokesmodel for, you know, whatever the latest thing that Ron Popeil has and make her the Bionic Woman, because celebrity is a completely different thing now. It doesn't necessarily mean... And we've also had scandals in both the astronaut community and the sports community, right? I mean, Kobe Bryant in sports and that crazy astronaut that drove for 17 hours with a diaper. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I mean, there's nothing is, I mean, find the right stuff at this point. I mean, find that, you know, quote, right stuff who that hero can be. I think that's part of the reason that you don't have as many black and white heroes today, because our black and white heroes got, I mean, screwed up. The president of the United States was caught, you know, covering up a break-in in 1974. The most recent George Bush, whether you like him or not, or Barack Obama. I mean, we're now in the habit not of thinking, well, the president of the United States, that means something. I mean, half the country, no matter who's in office, half the country thinks the guy in office is a dick. I mean, you don't have, it's almost like in society, you don't have that kind of hero anymore. You going to do a priest or a preacher? They've kind of had some hard luck over the past few years.
Yeah.
Who's going to be your automatic hero? Maybe babies. Maybe our next superhero should be a baby because they're pretty much the only ones that are blameless in society at this point. Otherwise, past 5 years old, you're kind of screwed as far as your bona fides.
I think they already did the Baby as Superheroes movie.
Did they really?
Yeah, I vaguely remember seeing part of a movie with one of my little nieces.
Oh, well, never mind. Yeah. This is why dog movies are going to be like, they're going to come back. We're going to get a new Benji. We're going to get a new Lassie. just can't be a pit bull because, of course, they're evil too.
Yeah, poor Spuds McKenzie. He really got a lame deal there.
Yeah, just refer to him as a Staffordshire Terrier.
There you go.
Because that doesn't sound scary to people.
That's true.
All right. And wait, so we're doing Dogs This Week. That's the podcast, right?
That's right. Next week are cats, so we'll have Jeff back to talk about Nightshade.
Yeah, I'd ask her on as a guest, but she's very demanding.
Mm.
And very particular about the show she goes on.
She wants her own room and catering and that kind of stuff.
And she gets it.
Yeah. Of course. If you don't want to add anything to the tail end of that, we can move on to... I did want to ask Ken, if you don't want to give a review of Rise of the Apes, is there anything you wanted to say about it since you were... very adamant about promoting it.
I thought it was super. I didn't promote it. I was really excited about it. And then I saw it and it did not disappoint me at all. It's fairly intelligent science fiction. It's not hard science fiction. I mean, there's a miracle drug in it. And then when they need another miracle drug, boom, he comes up with one. So, I mean, you know, this is not working out, like, how do we get from, you know, here to the moon or anything like that in fiction form. But as far as being a reboot, again, to use that term, as far as being a reboot of the Planet of the Apes franchise, awesome, totally great. I mean, and there, if you're a fan of the original movies too, there are just things all the way through it that you're like, oh, this could end up being like that. Oh, this could end up being like that. Oh, this could end up being like that. So, I mean, in those respects, it was great. It was also really neat to see monkeys that you could believe were monkeys as opposed to guys in a monkey suit. Well, guy in monkey suit or guys in monkey suits. I don't think there was more than one guy in any of the monkey suits. But
I mean, right, really... not that kind of a movie.
No, God, I hope. No. Oh, God. Now I'm trying to think of... porn titles for Planet of the Apes movies.
Planet of the Rapes, yeah. You know.
Oh, good God. Wow.
That's the most obvious one, right?
Gee whiz. I didn't even think of that. Ah, my head. Now my brain needs scrubbing.
I thought it was a fire brush. I'll lend it to you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I thought it was really super. I mean, there's not a whole lot of great acting in it, except for by Andy Serkis and, you know, a couple of moments from John Lithgow. James Franco is there to play the part of the doctor, kind of like everybody in every other science fiction movie. Mm-hmm. And not much was demanded of him. He delivered fine. Really, what was exciting was just all of the possibilities that were laid out in it. I don't even honestly know if the movie was as well executed as it could have been. It's just exciting to see exciting, you know, ideas. It's exciting to see that there are a million directions that they could go with it now. It's exciting to not see, you know, to not know, even knowing how it's going to end. There were so many other things along the way. I mean, it's called Rise of the Planet of the Apes. I mean, you go in knowing.
Yeah, you know where it goes, yeah.
Right, there's no mystery. It's not like, oh, well, maybe man's going to pull it out here. No, it's called Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Okay, so we pretty much know how it's going to end, and yet there were so many different things that went on in it and so many different sort of like possibilities that were laid out in it that you don't know necessarily what the next one's going to be, assuming that there is a next one, which I think is a fairly safe assumption. So, I mean, it was just exciting to see so many other possibilities laid out there as opposed to the, you know, the guy's going to get the girl or, you know, the guy's going to save the earth from being destroyed or whatever. Although Knowing, if you haven't seen Knowing, there's a surprise in that one. Sorry.
Which one
are we doing? Are we doing a spoiler?
Feel free. I've warned people.
Okay. Knowing was the Nicolas Cage movie where you find out that his kid is predicting the end of time.
Oh, that one.
And you spend like half the movie thinking, well, how is Nicolas Cage going to stop this? No, he's not. World's going to end. Ta-da. But you don't, you don't find that out until pretty much near the end of the movie when you're like, oh, so when they said there was nothing we could do, this is not like one of those movies where somebody says, unless, nah.
Yeah. Or, yeah. At the end, they go, wait, if we reverse the neutron polarity, we might be able to stop. No.
Push the Omega 13 button. Nope. Turns out not. Turns out there's absolutely, and even if they did that, that would just be 13 more seconds, right? No.
Right.
Yeah. There is a way that humanity survives, but I'll leave that there. So go ahead and watch Knowing if you want to. Just have a scotch.
That's pretty much expected, I thought.
Well, I haven't seen it yet, but I'm definitely going to see it at one point or another. I was, you're going to hate me, but I was actually a fan of the Tim Burton Planet of the Apes. Not that I really thought it was the best, like, story layout, because, like I was thinking about it today, and it's like, man, how would they have done a sequel to that that wouldn't have sucked? But I do appreciate the way they kind of rework things. I mean, it wasn't the same as the original. They've kind of messed with the timelines and stuff, but I thought it was a relatively good effort.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't hate you for liking it. I mean, I saw it in the theater and I own the DVD because it's an Apes movie, and I'm still that 6-year-old kid when it comes to the Apes movies. I mean, it was just neat to actually see it. I mean, I think the original series was fairly intelligent, although way dated, not only in the special effects, but the...
Oh, did I lose you guys? Oops, did I cut out? Did you cut out?
I don't know. I was here the whole time as far as I knew.
Okay. Sorry, repeat the last couple of sentences because I didn't hear it, just in case it didn't get recorded.
What did I say, Jeff? Do you know?
You disappeared on my end, too. Both of you disappeared on my end.
Hmm. All right.
So I was assuming it was just me.
Okay. We'll blame Jeff.
Okay. Yeah, it's my fault. Sorry, dudes.
Basically, what I was saying was they were like the original Planet of the Apes movies were fairly intelligent in their storylines, but they're also incredibly dated. So, I mean, it's neat to see this one not be that way. The Tim Burton thing. I mean, it sort of felt like that's the whole nostalgia thing that you were talking about earlier. It's like, oh, I liked Planet of the Apes, and this still is people in ape suits, and so I still kind of like the idea. But, yeah, it could have been 1,000 times better, and I think Rise of the Planet of the Apes is more than 1,000 times better than the Tim Burton thing.
You know, I was actually thinking about skipping Rise of the Planet of the Apes until it was like Netflix streaming, simply because, while the Tim Burton Apes movie I thought was just a fun diversion.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't enough to make me think, oh my God, I have to rush out and see Rise of the Planet of the Apes. But based on your endorsement, well, maybe now I will.
Well, I mean, one has nothing to do with the other. That's the thing. I mean, somebody said to me that they felt like they should see Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes before they saw Rise of the Planet of the Apes. They have nothing to do with each other. And I read an article sometime, like years ago. I can't remember. Is it Paramount? Who is it? Whatever the studio is, was actually very upset with Tim Burton because he, at the end of the Planet of the Apes, of that movie, he basically made it impossible for them to go back and do any kind of sequel. So, I mean, Tim Burton's thing is sort of like, think of it sort of like when they have a guest artist do like an issue of Superman that has nothing to do with Superman. It's just, you know, okay, well, this guy's interesting, so we'll have him do that. Or like when the X-Files had, I think William Gibson wrote an episode of the X-Files and Stephen King wrote an episode of the X-Files. It wasn't any part of the canon. It wasn't part of like what actually happened. It was sort of like...
Just a weird story with the same characters.
Right, right. So this will be this person's interpretation of that. You can pretty much look at Planet of the Apes that way. But yeah, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, dude, see it on the big screen. Seriously.
All right.
I mean, if you feel like you have to see it at matinee price, that's cool, but see it on the big screen because it's going to be a lot more fun than Netflix.
Was that one done in 3D or was that one of the few that wasn't this year?
I don't know. I didn't see it in 3D. I don't believe it was.
You know, am I alone in my dislike for most 3D movies?
Nope.
Well, depends on the movie. I don't dislike 3D because of its being 3D. It was funny because I saw Pirates of the Caribbean in 3D just because that was the show at the time that I wanted. And then shortly after that, I can't remember what I see. Oh, I saw Harry Potter, but not in 3D. And since I had kind of seen them back to back, it made Harry Potter feel flatter.
Hmm. Interesting.
You know, most of the 3D stuff I've seen has felt so gratuitous. And of course, I wear glasses, so having to put these other glasses on top of my glasses isn't very comfortable.
Yeah, I have the same problem.
You need prescription 3D glasses.
Yeah, but then you need to have, like, I think four different pairs, because there's the different 3D systems in the theaters, and so you have to have the right glasses for the right 3D. But I actually did consider that at one point, and then I thought, you know, if this is what I have to do to make 3D movies really tolerable, then I don't want to do that. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say there actually, I mean, it feels like the only one that's been worth it was Avatar. And that's probably because, you know, James Cameron was thinking in those terms when he was making it. Avatar, I thought, was completely immersive. It did not get in my way of the enjoyment of the movie at all. And it didn't feel like there were any cheap tricks being done to make me go, hey, 3D. Like when I saw Alice in Wonderland against my will.
Uh-huh.
The Johnny Depp version. The only showing that was going on was 3D. And so I had to pay the 3D price, which annoyed me. And then I had to go in. And it was like the Cheshire Cat's bouncing head as we're running towards something. I mean, was just there for the 3D effect. I know the Cheshire Cat, you know, disappears as the Cheshire Cat smiling, but I don't remember us having to chase the Cheshire Cat's bouncing head in the story of Alice in Wonderland. But suddenly we have to, because they got to justify the $15 for 3D. Plus, I hear the glasses are nasty. Even though they say they disinfect them, I hear the glasses are nasty.
I have no desire to be part of that game. I mean, yeah. Now, okay, so the 3D movies I have enjoyed have been animated.
Yeah.
And the first one that I saw that I thought was done very, very well was Polar Express. And the 3D stuff that I've seen from Pixar I thought was good. And for animated stuff like that, I prefer Pixar. But if you want to see, in my opinion, the best use of 3D in movies, you go watch a DreamWorks animation movie. Because those guys totally know how to do 3D. And it doesn't hurt. It's immersive. And it's not gratuitous.
All right. Is there one in particular? Or just anything? Like Shrek or... Well, that's not out anymore, though, is the problem.
Yeah, that's not out anymore. The How to Train Your Dragon, I thought, was done very well in 3D.
Okay.
And the one where it's like 50s B-movie characters that have to fight monsters versus aliens.
Yeah, that one was good, yeah.
Those were both very good uses of 3D.
You're such a geek.
All right. I'll take it to a new geek level. So when I have visited DreamWorks Animation Studios and been in their private video or movie showing, they have a theater right there at the facility. And then having the engineers that are in charge of all their 3D content actually demonstrating how the whole system works for you on their big screen. Now that's cool.
That is cool.
So anyhow, I've had some fun learning about 3D for movies.
It's going to be interesting if 3D ever becomes more mainstream. Like, I know they're trying to push 3D televisions now.
And... Oh, that's a crock of shit. I'm sorry. Can I say that?
You did, so.
I'm sorry about that.
Please either pile or bag, not crock.
Okay. All right. Having seen 3D television at two CES events in a row, I actually got kicked out of one of the vendors' booths for telling them what a horrible ripoff this was, and that I couldn't believe that they were trying to hoist this off on consumers. It's, in my opinion, 3D television is simply a tool that TV manufacturers are using to try and artificially create a market to sell new televisions. Because once everyone has a really nice HD TV, why do they need to buy another? Well, it's because now there's something new that comes along that their TV can't do, in this case, 3D. And it is crap, absolute crap. I have yet to find a 3D television that I thought was even marginally acceptable. Anyhow, I'm sorry, didn't mean to interrupt. Continue.
No, that's fine. Interesting. I haven't looked at any 3D televisions myself. But one thing, I was at an event at Autodesk, and they had a whole bunch of their technology out lying about for people to look at. And they actually had a TV showing kind of a looped video of kind of like a 3D modeled environment. And you did not need any glasses for it to look like 3D. And it was pretty mind-blowing that I could just... The only downside was you had to be like almost dead center in front of the television.
Yeah, that makes sense. The TVs that I've seen that did that, they were actually doubling up the LCD layers. Mm. So you had light coming through both of them, and if you're not dead center, then you have parallax problems.
Right. But and the other thing was it the Nintendo DS 3D? I thought was also kind of cool. Just the idea that you could actually do passable 3D without having to deal with glasses and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, which is cool, I guess.
But I think I wouldn't even consider getting a 3D TV, except like my 5-disc copy of Tron already came with a 3D version, which is another movie that I thought made good use of 3D.
Oh, yeah, I guess I did see Tron in 3D, and that was done well. Part of what made that work was the fact that it wasn't 3D all the time.
Right, right. What was the other thing? Oh, I also got to see Tron in a theater. I forget what they called it, but basically they had a motion simulator seats, and that was really cool. Because like we're on the bikes, when they were on the bikes, you know, like the chair would, shake and like whenever there was like if somebody, you know, when they did the light cycles and were kind of like banging them off to the side, your chair would kind of go off to the side.
Well, that's kind of fun, especially if you've been drinking.
Especially if you've been drinking. But, yeah, I don't know. I've heard some people, I suppose people who are prone to motion sickness weren't too keen on it. But I thought it was just great. The more immersive, the better.
Pregnant women and people with heart conditions should not see Tron Legacy in this theater.
That's right.
All right. Well, let's move on to geek moments. I don't know if you guys have this, but... or have something to contribute, but the idea was the geek moments, you know, to tell a little story or an event of something that really demonstrates your geekiness. No volunteers?
I don't want to go first.
Well, I was actually I know I've done lots of geeky things. I was having trouble thinking of anything really, really good, but I do have to admit a certain embarrassment to waiting in line for at least 14 hours around the block to get tickets to see episode 1 of Star Wars.
That was the first time I actually bought tickets online.
Oh, yeah. That would have been the smart way of doing it. Oh, yeah, actually, well, the theater was not selling the tickets for like the first day online. So if you wanted to see it on opening day, you had to get it at the theater.
Oh, no, my boss decided that he wanted to take the whole office to see episode 1 because he and I are about 6 months apart from each other. So we grew up with the same sort of, you know, mythology. And he wanted to take everybody. And he and I were actually the only ones that left enjoying it. He actually enjoyed it. I enjoyed it because, you know, well, we hadn't seen new Star Wars anything for a while. And also, I was still in denial.
Yeah, that was the thing, is the initial elation got you through. It's like, it's Star Wars. And then after you had to watch Jar Jar a few more times, it just totally deflated it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting, though, that that's your geek moment, because mine was about Jedi.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was the day after school ended in 1983. And I got up at, which is unheard of now. I can't even imagine I did this then, but I got up at like 5:30 in the morning because the first bus through my neighborhood to take me to the nearest theater that had it, was a 6:10 bus.
And I back then it was limited engagements for our movies.
Huh? Yeah. Well, wait a minute. What do you mean?
Meaning there was one theater that had exclusive rights in a city to show the movie.
No, there was definitely more than one, but this was a movie palace. This place, unfortunately, is no longer a movie theater. But it was the Bellmead Theater, which sadly, as I say, is no longer in Nashville, Tennessee. The theater itself still stands, but it's no longer a movie theater.
It's a Starbucks, right?
No, it was actually a bookstore for a while, and now I don't know what it is. I think it might be a grocery store. It's still shaped like a movie theater. But no, here's the thing. It was the movie theater forever in Nashville. So like you had Doris Day's autograph and Jimmy Stewart's autograph and you had like all kinds of autographs of people and pictures of them coming in, meeting with the owner of the theater or the manager of the theater on these two marble tablets. And on those tablets, there were also autographs for names you know, like Robert Redford and R2-D2 and C-3PO. So this was like an old movie palace with a balcony and everything, though the balcony was closed, always closed. So I got down to the theater at like 6:25 because I didn't live that far from it. I could have actually walked if I'd been thinking. And there were five people in line, and I was kind of bummed because I wanted to be the first person in line. But then they started selling tickets about 30 or 40 minutes before showtime. And for some reason, I think it's because they had friends who were in line. So the people who were further back in line. So the people who were first in line did not go in. And I was actually the first person through the door to see Jedi after waiting for like 6 hours. And then I did not go into the theater because I knew they were going to open the balcony because I had always wanted to be in the balcony of this theater and they had never opened it. For any movie that I had been there for. So I actually got to go front row center for Jedi and, you know, thoroughly enjoyed that because it wasn't until a few years later that I realized, hey, those are teddy bears beating the Empire. What the hell? I was 13 at the time, so I was like, ah, this is awesome. Because, you know, it was when I was 13.
That's about the only time Ewoks are awesome. But, yeah. But they're still better than Jar Jar.
Oh, yeah, 1,000 times. Well, I mean, you got Little Fuzzy to go on, right? I mean, you can believe that they could do something. Jar Jar, you just can't. There's nothing believable about that at all. It's just sad and tragic. Yeah. It mars the mythology forever.
It's really sad.
What's yours, Jeff?
All right. So I was trying to think of something that would be at least reasonably fun to share. And
it can be embarrassing or totally inappropriate as well. So,
all right, I'll save totally inappropriate for another episode. All right. So when I got to see the original Superman movie, when it came out, that's back when we had a limited engagements. So it was exclusive. And there was the theater in Denver that was showing it, lines just every single day, all day long, because everyone wanted to see this movie. So my dad finally agreed to take me to go see Superman. And so here I am, this, you know, not a tiny size person. And then here's my dad, who is 6'4". And so he went to, this is proof my dad loved me, because he went and stood in line for a few hours with me to see this movie, and he just couldn't even understand why in the world we had to stand in this line and why we had to pay so much money to see a movie. When they opened the doors and let us in, everyone just storms the lobby. And so this lobby is shoulder to shoulder with people. And then when they finally opened the doors to let us into the theater itself, it was like a riot. And this is not even opening day. The movie had been out for at least a month. And so these people are just pushing and shoving and trying to fight their way into the theater. And here I am, this kid, and I'm just getting kind of swept up in the motion and actually being pulled down, and I'm starting to get worried that I'm getting pulled under people's feet. And so right as I have that piercing moment of fear, when I think, oh crap, I'm a kid and I'm about to die before I get to see Superman, this massive hand reaches down through the crowd, and it's my dad, and he grabs me by the shirt and just lifts me up in the air and walks, holding me up, and just plows through the crowd. And, you know, people are now pissed off because here's this big man just holding a kid up in the air and taking me on through and into the theater. And so that's my experience getting in to see the original Superman movie.
That's a good story.
That is. Your dad was almost like the real life Superman for you in that movie.
Yet without a cape.
Without a cape. More subtle.
There was nothing subtle about that.
Well, that's a great story. Thanks for sharing, you guys. The last bit before signing off is Geek Pick of the Week. And I know you guys might not have had time to pick anything, which is okay. I went through boxes of books recently and pulled out a lot of things that I hadn't read for ages. And one of the things that caught my eye was a book by, well, actually, it's a series by Barbara Hambly. And it's called, there's actually two really good series she does. One is called The Windrose Chronicles, which has The Silent Tower, The Silicon Mage, which is always one of my favorite titles, and The Dog Wizard. And then the other one was the Darwath Trilogy, with The Time of the Dark, The Walls of Air, and The Armies of Daylight. And they were both really great series. I especially liked the Windrose Chronicles because it was like magic and technology combined. There was a wizard who poked a hole between universes to come into our world to steal technology to help him live forever.
Wow, what a douche.
Yeah. And so it was really interesting. I kept flipping back between this kind of like almost, Arthurian magic wizard kind of world, and then like modern day cubicle office land. And then this woman kind of gets kind of sucked into this whole battle between this bad wizard and these good wizards who are trying to find the bad wizard and stop him and stuff. And it's really well done. She's done a lot of series. The last one I read chronologically was Traveling with the Dead, which was a vampire book. I don't know if she did any after that, but I don't know if I could go back and read that one. I'm so burnt out on vampires in the last few years. But that's my recommendation. If you're looking for a good science fiction story, check out Barbara Hambly, and that's Hambly. Does anybody else have a recommendation?
I took the time while you were talking to come up with something, actually.
Awesome.
And this is a book that I'm reading on my iPad, but of course it's also available in traditional non-volatile data storage, meaning print books. And it's called Demon, and it's by Daniel Suarez. And Demon spelled D-A-E-M-O-N. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of this interesting story about this very successful game designers. It'd be sort of like a World of Warcraft sort of game. And he dies and like from cancer or something. And then before he dies, he wants to leave a legacy, and he's pretty bitter. So he creates this entire computer system that's designed to essentially bring down all of society around the world. And so it's the race between the people that are involved in figuring out what's going on and the computer system that's trying to stay ahead of them. And it's just kind of a fun little intriguing book.
Be sure to send me info about that so I can put that into the show notes.
Oh, great. Now I have homework.
Well, then I don't have a pick.
Oh.
Forgive me. My dog is barking in the background. I do apologize.
That's okay.
I've got one really quickly. It's one of my favorites. I've read it two or three times. It's not happy-go-lucky. It's called The Stars, My Destination by Alfred Bester, written in the 1950s, I think. And it's an awesome sort of man versus man and man versus himself kind of thing. Starts off with this guy who is just really, I mean, he is the ass end of space and spacefaring, and he knows it. And he just, I mean, his biggest deal is to just keep making money until he's dead. And I don't mean like be rich, but I just mean just, you know, get by. And it then is his track to basically remaking the galaxy or the world around him in ways that you don't really expect. And it's just a tremendous read, I think. Also a fairly short read, a fairly easy read. I mean, it's not, I mean, we're not talking about Dune or, you know, anything like that. I mean, we're really probably about 250, 300 pages tops. With a really neat 1950s kind of feel, but not you know, Sky Captain in the World of Tomorrow kind of thing. I mean, it's a real character in a way.
Ray Bradbury-ish?
Less Bradbury. I mean, Bester really sort of... I mean, I know Philip K. Dick is considered by a lot of people the father of today's science fiction, but Bester was on to some stuff already. I mean, company names have passed into people's names. Now, sadly, a lot of the companies don't exist anymore. But very, very Gibson in a way of like there's the Esso family, Esso having been an oil company back in the day, or a gas company.
Precursor to Exxon, actually.
Exactly. Exactly. And other cute little things like if there's a Mr. Atwood, it's written, you know, like at symbol and then WOOD. And there's a guy named Quarter Mile in the book. And the typography is, I mean, it's 1/4 mile, stuff like that. I mean, he had an interesting and he's not Bradbury. He's not Asimov. He's not somebody that survives in a way that when you read like that, or The Demolished Man was another one of his books. And those are actually the only two that I've read. But when you read his work, you kind of feel like he kind of gets short shrift, because Bester is not somebody that rolls off the tongue the way Asimov or Clarke or a bunch of other people do, probably because he's not hard science fiction. I mean, there's nothing as impressive about what he predicts, because he's not predicting geosynchronous satellite communication, and he's not, you know, predicting nanobots going through the human body. But well worth the read, especially, I think, The Stars, My Destination. Just a tremendous book, I think.
Well, cool. I'll definitely look at that, because I'm looking for some new old reading material.
Sadly, not available in the iBookstore, but it might be available on Amazon for the Kindle. I'm not sure.
Okay. If you send me the name and titles again, I will. If I find them in the Amazon store or otherwise, I will put links to those in the show notes as well.
No, that's right. I forgot. I have no pick. No, I'll send that to you when we're done.
Awesome. Okay, well, I think that's it for this week. I haven't quite decided how often this is going to happen. I'm kind of loosely putting it at every 2 weeks, just to give me some extra breathing room for figuring out how to compile the audio and set things up. So if it starts going really smoothly, we might do it more often.
Here's my advice. Instead of at the end of each episode saying, see you again next week, say, see you next time, or something like that. Because now you've given yourself an open end. You haven't committed to a tight time schedule. And that's it. That's my advice.
Oh, okay. I will do that. What was I going to say? Oh, you guys are welcome to come back next time. Be regulars. I will let you know when the next one's coming up. And I'm also going to try and get some other people to chime in on some other things as well. So if you're going to be back on, keep it in the back of your head, something you want to talk about.
Okay.
Ken has nothing to talk about.
Yeah, you know, I don't. I really, it was a struggle coming up with those. I don't know if you could hear.
I don't know. I think so far the audio count here is like 1 hour and 20 minutes, and I think Ken was 45 minutes of that.
All right, fine. Well, I'll see you next time.
Yeah. No. I really appreciate you, you kind of bringing the large thinking aspect to the podcast. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me. I do appreciate you asking me to be on.
Awesome. And if you guys, do you guys want to plug anything before we leave?
I have a show.
All righty. And Jeff?
I have a news site.
Okay. Awesome. You also have a personal website, Jeff-O-Rama, which doesn't get updated very often.
I've been very busy. My other personal website, Fresh Brewed Tales, gets updated more often, though.
Oh, that one I didn't know about.
Yeah. So, all right. So I'll be Ken's pimp. So Ken Ray from macOS Ken is an amazing podcaster with all kinds of incredible insight into what's going on in the Apple and technology community. And he podcasts 5 days a week, and then even has a special podcast for his paid subscribers. So you can listen for free, or you can be a real good listener and pay for the subscription as well and get additional content. That's macOS Ken. How was that?
Oh, that was very nice. I appreciate it. There's one thing, if you don't mind, I'm going to add to you pimping me, and then I'll pimp you. There's also a live show every Wednesday night. Well, except I don't think it's going to be this Wednesday night, but there's a live show most Wednesday nights called macOS Ken Live, oddly enough, where we basically take calls about Apple news and news related to Apple news. Sometimes it's bigger topics. Like I said, it was going to do the capital F future thing, but this past week ended up being all about Steve Jobs' resignation. And people call in from across the country and around the world, and we chat, and that becomes a podcast as well called macOS Ken Live.
Is that still on Justin TV?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, if you want to do it live, it's justin.tv/macOS Ken. Most Wednesday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific. But I don't think it's happening this week. Oh. And then Jeff Gamet is managing editor of a website called The Mac Observer. You can find that at macobserver.com. But you do both news and commentary and analysis, both those three things. about Apple stuff. He's also got this this Firebrand thing, a column in there called Computing with Bifocals. Is that what it's called?
Nancy Rocks.
Yeah, no, is that actually what it's called?
Yeah.
Okay, there you go. Computing with Bifocals and Particle Debris and a bunch of other weird once-a-week things that people can check out. If they want sort of a, you know, condensed, say, version of what's
right.
going on. Yeah,
that's
there you
right.
go.
So yeah, check out at the end of the week. See what Ken has written for us.
Oh, me? I wasn't even talking about... Oh, you're too... Stop. Okay.
Oh, I know.
Okay.
Let's hug.
You want to?
Yeah.
We don't have pants, though. It might get weird. And we're also 1,000 miles apart. So, you know, for these two reasons, let's just pretend we did. I'll see you at Macworld.
Okay, that sounds good.
And both of you guys are, Jeff most of the time and Ken occasionally are on We Have Communicators.
Yeah, and, occasionally I am. Jeff is constantly.
Yes.
And, he's actually doing We Have Communicators right now.
Simultaneously.
That's right. And so I'm just not listening to what they're saying on that show, and they're just getting this exact same content. It's great. Michael thinks I'm stoned.
What are you talking about? What's Star Trek have to do with Mac? Anyway. Okay, that's great. And do you guys want to blurt out your Twitter handles for people to follow? You don't have to.
Oh, what the hell. Yeah, you can find me on Twitter. Twitter.com/jgamet. That's JGAMET.
And I'm macOS Ken just about anywhere you would think of it. So Yeah, Twitter and Instagram, especially.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of pictures of your dog on Instagram.
Lots of pictures of my dog and pictures of snow. Yes, no, only two pictures of corn dogs, but yeah, it was apropos. Anyway, so yeah, at MacOSCon, Twitter, Instagram, and other places that would have that kind of thing.
Awesome. Well, to everybody out there in podcast land, be sure to listen to those guys' podcasts and check out articles on the Mac Observer. And hopefully you will join us next time for episode 2, The Podcast Strikes Back.
Wait a minute. The Podcast Strikes Back should actually be episode 5, shouldn't it?
That's right.
You know what? I actually predicted you were going to correct me on that.
Really?
I said, no, I'm just going to do it this way and see if anybody says anything.
No, you see, because next week you should actually just rebroadcast this one and it'll be Attack of the Clones. See, clone. Huh? And the third one.
Oh, well played, sir.
Oh, thank you.
I'm also going to say that George Lucas has screwed up my ability to count to 10 since my early ages, so I'll blame him for that.
Yeah, I just thought I had missed the first 3, and now I just wish I had.
All right.
Because it's true.
Yeah. All right, well, you should be able to find the podcast on Podomatic by going to talkwithoutpants.podomatic.com. If you go right this second, not that you would because this isn't live, it won't be there because I haven't created the page yet, but it will be there. And just search for Talk Without Pants and it should pop right up. Show notes will be there as soon as everybody sends them to me. You can follow the trials and tribulations of the podcast by going to Twitter/TalkSansPants because Talk Without Pants wouldn't fit. So that's TalkSans, as in without, pants, PANTS. If you have any suggestions or subject matter you'd like covered on the podcast or like to respond to anything we said today, feel free to send us a note. Until then, live long and may the Force beam you up.
You're cool. Living on the edge, Ken.
Living on the edge! I do that.
All right, I saw the first Hellboy drunk.
Nice.
And, yeah.
That really helped a little bit.
Yeah, it was weird. It did something to my eyes because there's like this red guy. It was weird. But anyhow.
There's nothing like being fucked up and looking at Guillermo del Toro images.
Exactly.
Oh my God, no kidding. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Frackin' Skype 5.